Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. We'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2009 film Objectified, directed by Gary Hustwit. Objectified deals with our complex relationship with manufactured objects, and by extension, the people who design them. It explores the creativity behind everything from toothbrushes to technical gadgets. The film talks about the designers who re-examine, re-evaluate, and reinvent our manufactured environment on a daily basis, and about personal expression, identity, consumerism, and sustainability. The members of the panel include Jeffrey Day, Omaha-based principal of Min Day Architects and a member of the board of directors of Design Alliance Omaha, and Drew Davies, owner and creative director of Oxide Design Omaha. This presentation is presented in cooperation with Design Alliance Omaha and the Omaha Creative Institute. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, December 17, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to begin the program is Casey Logan, Communications Director of Film Streams.
We're really pleased to have two great panelists. Thank you both in advance for being here for this. To my right is Jeff Day. Jeff is the Omaha-based principal of Min Day, which provides informed, flexible design for a wide range of clients, sites, and projects, from individuals to art institutions, urban to rural settings, and furniture to large buildings. Jeff is a licensed architect in both California and Nebraska, and an associate professor of architecture at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he also runs FACT, Fabrication and Construction Team, an academic professional collaborative design lab that offers students a forum for exploring the complex relationships between thinking and making. And to his right is Drew Davies. Drew is the owner and creative director of Oxide Design, a communications and information design firm specializing in corporate identity, brand strategy, packaging, print, and website design. And also, as many of you know, Oxide has been a great partner to Film Streams from early on, so just about everything you probably passed through on the way in here tonight was designed in some way by Oxide. Everything from working on our brand identity to the marquee. So Oxide has been great to Film Streams. So it's great to have you both here. Just a little bit of background. I think a lot of you probably know this, The film that we just watched is considered the second in an ongoing design trilogy. A few years ago, the director, Gary Hustwit, he was actually looking for a film that was about typography and graphic design. And as he says, he didn't find it, so he went out and made it. So that film became Helvetica, which is about this typeface that's virtually everywhere in our culture, and it became kind of this launching point for a discussion about typography and graphic design in our culture. And then this film followed that, the one that we just watched, Objectified. There is a third part of the design trilogy that's going to be coming. And one of the things I thought was kind of interesting is that Gary Hustwit said that one of the things that made his job really easy with both of these documentaries is how well designers express themselves on film. And he said that that was probably because they spend so much of their time explaining what they do to their, as he put it, clueless clients. So, but I think the way that we'll do this, we'll begin by asking you both to react to the film, if there's anything that in particular that jumped out to you, any ideas. And then we'll go ahead and open it up to the audience for your comments and questions and feedback, and we'll just go from there. So, Jeff, anything in particular that jumped out to you?
Well, I think the thing that's important about this film, in terms of the way the director chose his subject matter, he focused on designers who are all interested in how design affects daily life, as opposed to design as some sort of extravagant sort of add-on. you know, most of the designers in the film are people who are focusing on, you know, things like this or my Muji pen, which, you know, I used to travel to London to buy these pens because they're so cool, and now finally I only have to go to New York. But there's, which is maybe unfortunate, it was a good excuse to go to London. But you know, it's how these guys, these designers, men and women, are focusing on how, for example, with this pen, I know when it's going to run out because it's clear and I can see the ink kind of running down, and it gets to the end and I throw it out, or because I don't think you can recycle these things, and move on. And so it's how designers are focusing on everyday things, which I think is really critical. It's a lot of people tend to think of design as sort of an extra thing that you get if you pay more, and you go to fancy stores and you're paying extra for design. And that may be true with some of the designers you saw on the screen. Certainly Mark Newsom's furniture is very expensive and so on, but Karim Rashid's work is, you know, pretty inexpensive for the most part, you know, and I think that's what's really important about how he sort of structured the film in terms of subject matter.
Drew?
Yeah. Jeff just said everything really important about that. I think one of the great things about this film is that it does, even for those of us that do design every day, it exposes you back to the thinking of the fact that everything around you has been designed. So rather than being this add-on, it really is integral to what we do. So you watch this film, and if you're me, you come down here and you sit down, and you think, well, these chairs are fascinating. Like, I wonder what the thought process was behind who put this chair together. It's this sort of woven parquet sort of chair. And then, you know, how long ago was this microphone designed, so on and so forth. And you start wandering back through the objects in your life and wondering that about them. But I think it does connect us to the fact that the process of design isn't just superfluous, it's actually absolutely integral to everything. To wrap up in terms of the film, like, my absolute favorite moment of this film that if I can convince anyone else to take home as their favorite moment, the discussion that Jonathan Ive, I suppose in contrast to a Mark Newsom or someone, says in this film, that the best kind of design feels inevitable, like it was just meant to be that way. And I think that's, for me, I could watch this film another 20 times just to get to that point and watch him say that. That's certainly the way I approach design, even from a graphic design standpoint, but really through all pieces of design. My kind of ultimate mantra can be summed up in that statement he makes, that great design should feel absolutely inevitable.
I think we'll just go right ahead and take any comments or questions or feedback from the audience.
Thank you. I felt the documentary is great, but maybe a little short on the profit connections with design. At one point, they talk about, well, human beings just need things new. And I think that's really quite a oversight of living in a society where consumption is the engine. And how, as a designer, is that tension between, well, we're really doing it so people live more comfortable lives, and we have to make money, and this pen has got to run out pretty often for the corporation to make money. So could you say a little bit about the tension in design of working for capitalists, but kind of being visible as for the common good?
I think from my point of view, I'm an architect, and I design, you know, buildings and furniture, which are typically things that last a long time, and people don't throw out furniture very often. You know, I've had one design, one architectural project of mine demolished, which was sort of an interesting thing because we designed buildings, and this was an interior that I designed in New York, and, you know, the person who bought the flat ripped everything out and threw it all away, and I thought, well, that's really a shame. I thought this would last, you know, 50 years, but, you know, it lasted 3 years. Despite the fact it cost $100,000 to build this interior. So it's interesting when you think about that from that point of view, but for the most part, what I do is work that does last a fairly long time, and so I focus on what would make something desirable over a period of time. And I suppose I've been isolated pleasantly from the need to design things that don't last. And so I think Karim Rashid was really sort of on point when he talked about making laptops out of cardboard, because you're going to get a new one in a couple of years anyway, so why should it be made out of this beautifully machined aluminum. I carry apples around because they're beautifully machined aluminum things, but at some point I've got to give it up because it doesn't really work anymore, and I can't just stick a new inside in there. It's done for. So I think obsolescence is really a challenge, and you know, it's how a lot of designers make their living because they keep having to design new cell phones and so on. You know, you can think about it in terms of materials as well. I mean, paint manufacturers could make paint that would last 20 years on the side of your house, but why would they? Because then you'll never buy any more paint. So they make paint that lasts a couple of years, and then you have to get more and redo it. And so there's a built-in desire in the producer's point of view to have obsolescence as a permanent quality of what they do. Even if the technology, I mean, with a laptop, sure, the technology does advance, and there may be needs to change to new equipment, but they're also interested in maybe advancing the profit on the entire object as opposed to just replacing certain components. So.
As a quick follow-up to that from the guy who designs things that get thrown away about 3.5 seconds after they're used, I don't have a great answer except to say that you highlight one of the absolute struggles, I think, of design versus commerce. Probably more often than not, people that design, architects, graphic designers, product designers, really come at that perhaps a little more altruistically. We're problem solvers, so we're looking to solve the problem way less, more often than make $1 million. But there is always that flip side about I suppose lots of people who are not designers but are looking to solve a problem that the problem is I don't have enough money and the solution is I'm generating more revenue. I think there's a constant tension there, and a lot of designers, even up through architects, face a constant daily struggle in terms of determining what's how far you're going to take that line and then how much of yourself you're going to put back towards actually just trying to solve the problem, profits be damned. So at Oxide Design, of course, we accept money from clients and we solve their problems, and sometimes that means designing postcards that get thrown out the minute they get seen. But we try and spend as much of our time actually solving problems that are going to be kind of lifetime solutions rather than just trying to sell somebody something they don't need. But I think that's probably a person-to-person struggle, even in the design world. Sorry, I can't answer your question better than that, but there may not be an answer.
Kind of along the same line, there was a woman in the film, I forgot her name already, but she was talking about designing policy and kind of design as problem solving. She didn't really expound upon how designers would kind of leap into this whole new world of problem solving, like kind of crossing boundaries. Like when I think about all sorts of different problems that exist, it seems like there's a lack of connection between the people who study very specific skills and the people they would need to make leaps forward across and make eureka kind of moments happen. If that makes sense, I don't know. How do you think we can make that happen or help make that happen, I guess?
That is a fantastic question. The ultimate designer utopia has always been this sense like, well, damn it, we're the best at solving problems. Somebody should ask us to solve a real problem. And that's exactly what I think that was Paula in the film that was talking about that. At least as designers, we sit around thinking, no one's using our talents really like at the ultimate level. We should be able to solve global warming or poverty or something with this, or at least governmental agencies should be asking us to do that. And I think there may be, without sounding overly egotistical, there may be some truth to that. Certainly, the best of designers are trained problem solvers. So, some of us strive every day to at least go about solving a problem, a lot like the IDEO example in this film, that idea that, hey, we could make a better toothbrush. Or we could scrap that idea altogether and we could figure out how to solve the whole problem of oral care. And I certainly spend my days trying to move from make better toothbrush to solve problem of oral care. I don't know a great answer to your question about how do we move that, how do we shift that ability up a couple of levels in terms of acceptance by society, I think, is one of them, and then moving into spots where that broader picture problem solving is really put into place. Although I think there's a possibility that we're actually moving slowly but surely further in that direction, just the more that people begin to recognize that design solutions are being made intentionally in the world around them. You know, the word design has become a buzzword lately where actually, you know, IKEA and Target and whoever gets to use design, and people think, oh, I like design. That sounds neat. Like, I'll take some. Sign me up. And I do think we are moving towards a little bit more respect for what that can mean beyond having a trash can that's a little bit prettier than the last trash can you had, but starting to think about a whole new way to collect your trash. So maybe we're at least moving in that direction.
I mean, in our practice, we like to quote Marcel Duchamp, who said, there is no solution because there is no problem. And I think the problem with design problems is that we use the word problem, and that presupposes that there's going to be an answer out there, and our job is just to sort of figure out what it is. And I think the toothbrush example is great. If they were just asked to design a toothbrush, they would design a toothbrush, but they tried to go beyond that because they're not really solving that problem. They're looking beyond the problem to something else. And so we try not to think of our practice as one that solves problems. And I think when you start to look at the so-called problems of the world, there really are the inverse of the solution sort of built into it. And so if we start thinking about looking out for the problem, we're sort of going in a very linear fashion. And I think if we forget that idea that we're here to solve a problem, we're really here to exploit an opportunity, we end up, I think, producing something that's maybe more innovative. And whether we're talking about things that we deal with directly, sustainable design or social problems in the city, a lot of these come from maybe more open-minded thinking, I think, than the sort of linear fashion of problem solving.
Silence. I guess this sort of picks up on that same theme. But one of the subjects of this, I guess, this talk is design and its relationship to our community. And I'm curious what you think and what those of you in the audience think that the state of design in this community is, and then if there are any steps that could be taken that make that relationship better within this community. I'm struck by the example in the film, and it was such a simple one of the chair of why is there any, you know, why is there such a thing as an uncomfortable chair? And then there's the picture of people waiting for a bus or for a streetcar. And, you know, it seems like on that sort of street level way, how does the seating get designed? Are there any thoughts about design and its relationship to the Omaha community and what could be done better? So there are.
I mean, I think the first answer to that is this event here, events like this where we have people from Omaha watching a film like this and talking about it. You know, maybe you guys will head out and think about something or drive home and drive by a dumpy-looking bus stop and think about why it looks like that. And that's the start, getting people to talk about it.
Actually, speaking of dumpy-looking bus stops, I don't know if you've gone up Farnham Street lately and seen what they've got on those bus shelters, the transparent, translucent, whatever they are. I think they're glass. Beautiful. Another example that comes up to me, since I ran benchmarks some years ago, we had lousy bus benches in Omaha. I asked for a new design and actually showed the company a design I thought would work better. There is a new company running the bus benches now, and they've got some pretty decent designs out. I don't know if you've noticed them, but they're way more aesthetic than the old ones. So there's two examples.
can barely talk, but I do want to say this, that recently there are people from the North Downtown Alliance, which is a newly formed group, that listened to the new city planning director talk about his view or the city planning's department's view of North Downtown. And one thing he said was very interesting was, you know, we've been talking in city planning about always trying to figure out how it would impact those of you that have businesses or live in North Downtown. But we realize we've never talked to you before. We've talked about how it would impact you, but we've never really talked to you before. And it was very telling because it was a good opportunity for people there to say, we'd really like to be part of that conversation. And it's in this city, it's not a natural thing, I don't think, for the people that make the decisions about how the city looks and how it operates to talk to those that might be impacted by it. But that's a hopeful comment, at least.
I'm going to say this on in regards to like our mission, and the reason that we had everybody here tonight is that it's a lot about breaking down, what's the word for it, the aloofness of what people would say is design. I mean, you have the right basically to sit there and complain if the chair doesn't, you don't like the way the chair works. And that's something that, that comes back to your city, it comes back to your house, it's your kitchen, all of those things. And I think the deal when you ask me about, you know, what do we think about design in the community of Omaha, it is basically starts as a conversation. We like to say that, you know, experience and exchange are the true constants of progressive design. Because like tonight, you've just experienced new things. You're going to be thinking about things differently. You'll be thinking about your community differently after you leave. And then the fact is that the other thing that we would hope would happen after you're done is the fact that I hope that you'll go places and you'll sit down and you'll have coffee and you'll talk. And the idea is that that conversation will create a better community. I mean, those are the things that really get things started. And then those will come into the fact that designers like Jeff and Drew, who actually work in that area, will apply that to your community.
I was kind of thinking about what you were saying and about how maybe possibly even capitalism is built upon like being a little bit selfish, you know, like you need something or some things you just need, you know. And for me, being a person, I look at that bench and I go, do I have a right to be comfortable, or am I selfish for wanting to be comfortable while I sit here? You know, if you think about like socialism or communism, where they take and everything is like rigid and like blocky, and you know, but like one of the good things about the kind of system we live under is like where if we need something, we can create it, and you necessarily don't, it's because you want it, you know, or you know, you're not like the government, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying I don't feel like I have a right to have a comfortable park bench or something, you know, to speak out, to actually say something about it is kind of a new concept for me, you know, like, do I have a right to have a good space or something? I don't know. But I think because capitalism is based upon like that lady mentioned, like having disposable pens or something. It's like I'm kind of selfish. I do want the new pen, so I go out and buy it. But it's a good thing, you know, because it builds economy and things like that. Like, I mean, some of it is self-reliance. I need to be able to write, you know. I need to have a good, like, is it selfish for me to want to like buy the next new comfortable pen or whatever, or I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying that I think that we live in a good country that has the type of where we can build things and do things for comfort because we want it, you know, and it's not selfish or whatever. Thank you.
Did you want to respond to that, Jeff?
I think we need a constitutional amendment for the right for good design.
So I wanted to respond to a couple things that I think both of you were saying, and maybe there's a question somewhere in here. One value of the film is that it talks about the sort of role of design in everyday life. And there's a certain point at which they talk about the need for, you know, to produce design for the other 90%. But I think it was Paola that was speaking about that, but then it sort of instantly she jumped to these highly conceptual designers who were sort of designing for, you know, for the mind and not much else. I think it's a big problem actually with the film that it didn't address any real models of, you know, design that maybe isn't solving problems but is rather creating solutions for people in areas of real need. Just happened to be watching Good Morning America this morning or something, some silly talk show, and they were showing these stoves, these sort of rocket stoves that a nonprofit has been making in Africa that allow the women who have to collect the wood to collect 20% of the wood that they normally have to collect because the stoves burn at a much higher temperature and they're sort of less danger of being attacked while they're collecting the wood. And I think, you know, okay, why hasn't this film really addressed those issues? And, you know, beyond the point of saying, let's get outside of designing a better bus stop and design a better bus system, didn't really address, I think, anything as far as like how to design a better world or how to create a situation where design is accessible to everyone in the world rather than just people who like, you know, sexy objects.
I have a secret dream that the third film in this series will actually be the film you're talking about. Because the one curious thing exactly right that this film does is puts up on a pedestal this very 10% of the world, all of these beautifully designed objects, and while some of them are skewing towards that best design of a utilitarian item, a lot of them are skewing towards that sort of. It's a little bit designed for design's sake. I mean, when Mark Newsom makes a bookcase that looks like lots of little honeycomb hive things put together, it's not a better bookcase as far as storing books goes. And nobody was sitting around thinking, geez, I wish I had something that was more efficient to store books on. Books are square. They fit in square spaces. Perfectly square bookshelves work really well for that. So he's designing for a balance between new and different and art and creative, thoughtful, but it's to put books on like
that the bookcase costs $50,000,
right?
Too.
And it's just ridiculously, yeah. So I do think you're exactly right. The film just completely skips over the fact that if you took the effort that he's putting into that and you took the money people are paying for these $50,000 bookshelves, you could the effect of solving a problem really well or exposing an opportunity really well could be so much better. The example you gave, there's actually the Smithsonian has started pushing a couple of programs where they're actually showcasing people that are doing this. A group of people invented these essentially thick straw drinking tubes that they distributed across a wide range of impoverished countries that they're tubes that actually filter water while you're drinking through them, and they basically don't need a filter, or the filter lasts 20 years or 300,000 gallons of water. And so in all of these places where they can't get fresh drinking water, they're distributing these thick straws where people can actually just shove them down in a puddle of muddy rainwater and drink through them and get drinkable waters and things like that. So it would be it'd be my ideal dream to see a lot of designers stop resolving a bookshelf for actually a chair, resolving the chair problem, which I think we got down pat pretty well at this point in time, and move on to some things that might make the same amount of energy might make a significantly larger difference in the world.
In reference question and other things we've been talking about here, you have to take into consideration there are all types of designers, and you have to have, to be a good designer, you have to have a lot of expertise in the area in, that you design in, and it doesn't mean that, I think a lot of this has been too broad and too general, and you talked about this movie being in three parts anyway, so we're not talking about what this movie was about, maybe getting into all of that other, even though that all relates to what we're doing. So I think that there's something that we haven't addressed either, and that what is good design? It's something different to everybody. You can show the same chair to five different people, and one person will think it's wonderful and appreciate everything about it. Another one will have it no understanding whatsoever about it. And another thing is people want change. People get bored. And they love change. It keeps them going. And finally, I will say that if you look at things that maybe you think are frivolous because they're only there because they're pretty, things that are beautiful are things that make people feel good. So you just take a look at Paris, and everybody loves Paris, wants to go to Paris, and those gold women up on the top of domes, they don't mean a damn thing in terms of what they're doing for the world other than making people feel good because they look pretty.
Speaking in like the broad terms and how design in general is becoming more accepted around our culture, how do you guys individually feel about the term creative class? Positive, negative, and what are your thoughts behind it?
I think it's kind of jargon, to be honest. I think it's it doesn't it doesn't really speak to anything that that I think is very interesting. I think that. Yeah, there are a lot of creative people. I think there are a lot of professional designers who do wonderful work. And, you know, to start talking about it as a sort of creative class or a movement that separates people from, I mean, who's the non-creative class? I mean, what are those people losers or what are we talking about? And I think it's sort of an odd way to sort of categorize people. I guess to respond to the earlier comment about beauty, I think that there is certainly a need for beauty in the world, and a lot of times good design is beautiful not because it has some form of ornament to it, but that it's inherently beautiful in terms of the way it functions, and that can be seen as beautiful. But that doesn't mean that there's no need for sort of ornamentation, and I, you know, a lot of our work is ornamental in many ways, and I don't have a problem with that. But I do think that designers are thinking about aesthetics. Obviously, they're not just dealing with practical problems or production problems or material problems, but they're dealing with aesthetics at the same time. It's a matter of trying to do that all at once. Back to my pen, I mean, I think that's a beautiful pen, but it functions very well, and you know, I probably bought it primarily because I like the way it looks. You know, same thing with my computers. I mean, I like the way they look, probably why I bought them. I probably could have purchased cheaper computers, but, you know, it's got to look good.
My question was, or my comment was really about how the language of design and how that connects with other communities and in terms of discussion about impact on the world beyond making a better bookcase or a pen. I think one very positive impact of design is that the language of innovation, rapid prototyping, and certainly human-centered approach is making an impact. And I think the drinking straw example is a good one, and there are other projects that come to mind, and certainly some of the work that the Gates Foundation is doing to fight fight disease in the third world is a big piece of that. And my question, just my comment and more my challenge is to think about how the language of design impacts whatever our worlds are, and I think we find a lot of things that So an example here locally about being human-centered is the Dodge Street Expressway that from an aesthetic point of view probably doesn't it's not as beautiful as the gilded domes of Paris, and from an urban planning point of view doesn't meet the needs of maybe living in a more sustainable community. But I would say it is a human-centered design, right? It was built to solve a problem that was very human for a lot of humans, and that was they're very frustrating through a high traffic corridor. So I would just throw it out there that the language of design, the processes of design are very transferable, maybe more than the products. And so this was objectified, and it was about these objects, and some frivolous and some not. And actually, my other question was, what's the third movie? Anyone know the title?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't think that they've announced
about
it.
Process or language? That's my hope.
I think your point's well taken about the idea of human-centered design, dovetailing into this idea about aesthetics. We all look around the city and we think there's all these design problems, like this is ugly or that doesn't work right or whatnot. The difficulty in that scenario is that doesn't work right or is ugly. I mean, these are subjective terms based on kind of how you're coming at that scenario. So does that expressway solve one problem that they were trying to solve by putting this thoroughfare of concrete through that space? Solved it perfectly, right? But if you come at it from a couple other angles, a lot of other people see it as sort of creating more problems than it solved, I suppose. But there is a sense, I think it's easy to fall into the trap that when we talk about good design, we understand it to be this universal standard, like only super trained, really, really great designers can understand. We recognize what great design is, and it's absolutely at this end of the spectrum and done. And I think your point's well taken that that's not really true. There's a lot of different ways of coming at scenarios, and whether it's aesthetic or solving certain problems with a priority over others, just because we don't care for that solution doesn't mean it's necessarily not good design.
I think going back to what I was saying earlier about problem solving, IDEO, they talk about human-centered design all the time. I mean, it's sort of their catchword. And they did a project once. A hospital company hired them to look at the hospital from the point of view of the patient. And in mind, they had, well, should we paint the walls blue or pink, or, what should we do here? And so what IDEO did is they didn't just start designing. They sent someone to the hospital. The person had a camera attached to their head and spent a day lying in a hospital bed, and then made the people at the hospital executives watch the film, which was basically a film of a ceiling, which at that time in most hospitals, it was the last thing that any designer had ever looked at. They never think about what does the ceiling look like, but that's what the patient sees all day long because they're lying in a bed. So it's about reinterpreting what the question is, and that's what I think what good designers often do. And IDEO is very well known for that kind of thinking. And you saw a little bit of their process, which is this sort of brainstorming process. They have these rooms where they have stickies. You can write on any wall, and you can do whatever you want. And they have toys and things to play with, so that their designers are constantly sort of coming up with ideas, trying to sort of always bring it back to the point of view of a user. And I think your comment about the expressway is really, I think, important. But they didn't. That answers one particular problem, but it doesn't reinterpret the question and think about how would Omaha perhaps be a better city if we had some decent public transportation for people living out in West Omaha. Instead, we solve the problem. Well, we need to make the road wider. Well, we're going to have to do it again, eventually anyway. And so it's just sort of pushes the problem out, over and over again.
I just had a brief comment just about it seemed to deal with form and function, but I think human nature is so much about the personal aspect of how I think people love inherently to try to express themselves. And so that's where, to me, some of the design form and function is – it's almost like a socialized thought instead of there was really no human personalized. I think people are hungry, and that's why people, when you said one of your projects, you know, cost $100,000, but somebody ripped it out, but it didn't express them. And I think that's the thing about human nature. It may or may not have been perfect for the person that it was designed for, but people are so hungry to. I mean, that's what I think consumerism is all about, is self-expression.
I mean, that may be another, maybe we're trying to guess what the next film is, but the next film might have more to do with personal expression and not so much everyday design. I mean, this one was clearly focused on everyday design.
As a designer, at our office, we're constantly critical all day of the tools we use, the computers we're on, the interface of the software we're using, the pens we have, et cetera, et cetera. It may seem contrary, but I think you're exactly right. And at the end of this film, you know, they started hinting at that idea about some things like rapid prototyping move forward and whatnot. Maybe the next step really is like sort of hyper-personalization. You don't have to worry about what Karim Rashid thinks you'd want in your stupid dirt devil. You make your own dirt devil, whatever you want. And it may seem contrary for a designer to say so, but that's really the world I'd rather see happen. I mean, if we could reach that point where, you know, the utopian spot where everybody gets to decide what their own dirt devil looks like or how they want to go about the problem of having dirt in the carpets in their house in the first place or what they actually want to put on the floor in their house in the first place, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that's a great place we could be at where, as a designer, I'd like the ability to do that sort of one at a time with my own experiences with objects. And I don't have a need to have that be, have my object be what everybody else is using. I'd rather they get to sort of select their own object in the midst of that. So
I think there's a danger, too, in looking at, you know, I think some people could come away from this film looking at design as objects. And I think there were a couple really good points made about, you know, the problem solving of design that we really are trying to make, whether it's paper or things you read or places you live or cities you live in, work better for people. And one of the great points was about the sustainability aspects of everything that we're designing, to really look at what happens to it when you're done with it. And the whole cradle-to-cradle concept of, you know, can it go back to the earth? And I think that's a great point that the film makes, because as designers, we all have to be considering, you know, what happens to what we've created.
I have just a couple of comments on several things. I think this is a great opportunity to think about consumerism and how that relates to design, and it's mostly what the film was about, but the discussion that's followed is a lot somewhat about process and how that process can be applied to not solve problems, as Jeff said, but to make a better world throughout. And I think there, the idea of a creative class maybe Ken Robinson talks about creativity and how there's creativity in all of us, and as we get closer to the opportunity to create our own objects, I think that's going to come out more and more and be more of a collective conscious to create, you know, a better world in parts of the world that suffer more, and the idea of having products, the cardboard phones, you know, all of that. There was a pretty significant piece on how things are recycled, and I think that's is going to, if we can all put our minds to solving that, it's going to put us all in a better place. So I appreciate you guys, all three of you, taking the time to engage this conversation.
Just a comment that I think applies to that and a couple other things that people have said. This isn't an answer. It's really more of a question for all of you, or at least something to ponder as we move forward. It's been suggested here that people like change, which is why we keep replacing all of these things. I think probably the reality is that people like new. Because the other thing that we find, even in the world of graphic design, is that people don't actually really embrace change. They do like things to be different. They like things to be new and fresh and shiny, but oftentimes they really aren't good at embracing things that take a different approach to solving the same problem. So I love this idea that Karen Rashid comes up with, the idea that let's make all of our mobile phones out of cardboard, because we all know when we buy them, we're not going to have them for 5 years. We're going to have them for a year, and then we're going to trade them in. That's not the kind of change that people embrace really well. So I dare you to go out and try selling cardboard mobile phones that do exactly what an iPhone does to people, because they won't buy it. Some people will buy it, and it'll take a long time to sort of catch on. But the paradox that we fight against in all aspects of the design we do at Oxide, from really concrete, what does this postcard look like, all the way up to how do we reframe this whole issue and come about solving it in a different way, is that human nature is kind of curious that way, where we do like things to be new and shiny, and I want to have the best gadget that just came out, but I want it to be painfully familiar in terms of the regularity of it being the same kind of mobile phone that I had before and the same one that I had before, and I don't want to have to change my behavior pattern, even if 30 minutes of working to change my behavior pattern saves me an hour of time every day. It's human nature not to want to go through that first 30 minutes of figuring out how to do something a different way. So that's there. That may be the lifelong, age-old, end-of-world human condition paradox, but I wanted to bring it up just a point for all of you to think about as you're out in the world contemplating design and object design and why we might not be moving forward on certain fronts, making something at the opposite end of the spectrum that solves a problem even better. It's a depressing thought, but I probably should keep that to myself.
I just wonder if the term object is problematic, because it just seems to me really to simplify what things are. Almost all the objects that we're looking at here, and so many of the objects that we deal with, they're not just objects, they're mostly all commodities. And that's like a really different reality. And I just think we have to think very differently in a fundamental way. And I don't know if there's anything like in the, you know, I mean, I think a number of things have been opened up in the discussion that might have implications too for you know, how designers, architects are educated, and how they may, you know, sort of get together and have ways of reflecting. I mean, we have a great opportunity this evening. That's great. But to kind of deal with the fact that you're not really just dealing with objects, you're dealing with social realities, and it just seems like it's not something that should be ignored. It just has to be thought about systematically.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, because one of the things that was not discussed in the movie was the social relationships behind the particular objects, the labor relationships behind the objects. It was interesting that whenever they showed an object being made, it was always by a machine. There was never a person involved in any manufacturing. And of course, we know that there are. They did show people in the recycling process, and that's awfully not a job that you want to have, because they're handling toxic computer parts all day long. And I think that's a really critical piece of this. And I think some designers do focus on, you know, where does this plastic come from and how is it made, and what are the implications of throwing thousands of these things away every single day. San Francisco banned plastic bags in supermarkets and any store. You can't, if you have a store in San Francisco, you can't sell things in a plastic, send them off in a plastic bag. You know, we can make those sort of decisions in Omaha if we want to, but we've got to really sort of investigate these issues. And I think that's something that was, you know, somewhat missing from the film, which would have been an interesting point. I guess the other issue about objecthood, you know, one of the things that I find interesting, and it has a lot to do with media, is that students now tend to be thinking much more about buildings as objects. And so when I'm sort of dealing with students at UNL in the studios, In fact, I had this entire semester, I taught a studio that was very much about trying to get the students to think about environments, not buildings, in terms of landscapes. And so the idea was to sort of take landscape and sort of think about it, how landscape can become architectural and how buildings become landscapes. But it's very difficult, and it's partly because of the way that we represent things now with digital media renderings and so on. We tend to focus on the building as an object, and it's a real challenge because we start thinking about a building in the same way that we think about this object here. And it's very different. You never think about what this looks like from the inside, but when you're talking about buildings, you obviously would have to be thinking about that as well.
Just real quick, do you think design will split into essentially, if I can use an analogy, with economics, kind of micro design for product, and macro design, design that deals only with systems and not actually products at all, of any kind?
I don't think it's probably going to split any more than it already is. There's probably realistically a spectrum, I would say, of those things out in the world that's in constant ebb and flow. I think there are probably people who are even employed in design in the world that shift from one of those into the next, either as career moves or as they evolve through different jobs. So I'm not sure there's exactly a split specifically that could happen any more than there is now. Does that make sense? I think it's probably just a spectrum of gray in terms of how people are applying their thinking at that point in time.
I'm most interested in designers who think broadly and don't specialize. There are a lot of designers who specialize in very particular areas, and I'm really interested in the design practices that are extremely broad, and IDEO is an example of that. They do everything from, they designed the first MAO, so they're sort of famous for working with technology companies, but they also do interior environments, office spaces, a lot of different things. And so they don't necessarily split up the discipline within the office with different people. There are individuals there who work on a great variety of things, and I think it's important that we try not to split design as a discipline into too many different sub-disciplines. It's all about the communication across disciplines that makes design innovation happen.
Drew and Jeff, I think we probably just have time for any final thoughts that you might have or anything that hasn't come up that you'd like to talk about?
I have a question. How many of you in the audience consider yourselves designers, whether professional or not? Is that 50%? 60? A few people left, so maybe they're the non-designers.
There is such a broad spectrum of the things we've been talking about tonight, and even what was covered in this film, that it's just nearly impossible to try and sum any of it up. I would say, in relation to a lot of the comments that have been made and what we've been talking about, I would suggest as a final thought that I do believe that all of us as human beings are designers. That's why I'm looking forward to that day when we can all design our own objects. We can all design whatever it is we interact with on a day-to-day basis. So that same idea about throwing out the idea that a creative class exists, because I think all of us should be able to take home from a discussion like this that's kind of open-ended, that really we all have the ability to reframe anything we encounter in our lives and kind of look at a different way to solve that or look at a different way to find opportunities. So as a parting thought, I'd certainly suggest that you take that home with you, that every last one of us has that creative ability to reframe problems and come at things from a different angle and create brilliant solutions.
Okay, well, thank you, Drew. Thank you, Jeff. I'm sorry, Tom.
No, this is totally just in closing. And Susan, I'm going to kind of speak for you, but this is just a thank you to Rachel and everybody and all of you here that are FilmStream members. Thanks so much for having us in your house tonight. It's pretty awesome just the fact that we're able to enjoy something like this. And that the organization itself exists. So I just wanted to say a big thanks to you and Casey for those of us that we don't have bricks and mortar. Thanks for letting us into your house tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a discussion on Noon Forum, which followed a screening of the 2009 film Objectified, directed by Gary Hustowitz. The event, presented in cooperation with Design Alliance Omaha and the Omaha Creative Institute, took place at Filmstreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, December 17, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The members of the panel were Jeffrey Day, Omaha-based principal of Min Day Architects, and a member of the Board of Directors of Design Alliance Omaha, and Drew Davies, owner and creative director of Oxide Design Omaha. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, Hallie Sharkey, and Jim Foyt of Filmstreams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.